Welcome to IPO, the show that explores the most innovative ideas, the inspirational people behind them, and the wealth of opportunities they create. And here to help you sort it all out, your host, Brant Penvidik.
All right, Big Ben, thanks for joining me, man. I'm very excited to have you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah. So listen, you've been blowing up lately, and I'm really excited to catch you on this sort of crazy meteoric rise, right? Because I think we've seen this, as I was saying in the intro before, like I've seen Gary Vaynerchuk, and I remember trying to cast him in a show, and then all of a sudden, whoop, up he goes, right? And so I can see that with Lewis, and there's a lot of this vibe and online and the connection with people, and you have it in spades. And as I'm watching your career like explode, I'm like, I got to get him in here now because he answers my phone call. And like a month later, I don't think you're going to answer when I call. I think I'm going to miss the intro there on the phone. When you get a new number and you only send it to certain people, I'm going to be out. So that's why you're sitting here now. So there you go.
I'm always going to come over to this house. All right, man. It's amazing. Yeah. Oh, thanks. Okay. To be in the same sentence as those guys is you made my day.
So. All right. Look at you, Mr. Humble. Yeah. All right. So let's play the get to know you game just a little bit. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Victoria, BC.
Oh my God. So did I. How crazy is that? Nah, I'm kidding. I knew that. So it's interesting as a Canadian kid.
Yeah.
What were you planning to do when you were a kid?
Man, you know, you had to play hockey. So I played hockey. Yeah. And then, you know, growing up in Victoria, rugby was a huge thing. So I grew up in a big rugby school. And so I played a lot of rugby. And I ended up, you know, getting pretty high up, you know, pretty quickly in high school. I ended up getting on like the U19 national team. And I was going on to university. Life was good. And then I was training for the World Cup. And I was the fly half. So I kicked field goals and I called a play. So it's like the quarterback and the field goal kicker in one position. And I started worrying about missing an easy kick, right? Like I was thinking, whoa, what if I blow it and like miss an easy field goal right in front of the field, like the goalpost at the World Cup? Like what if I totally blow this once in a lifetime opportunity? And so these thoughts kept going in my head, and they started coming as anxiety. And this anxiety, ultimately, it made it hard for me to sleep. And so this lack of sleep, this anxiety, all this pressure that I put on myself, I slowly slid into a depression, and I got depressed. And I dropped out of school. I got dropped from the rugby team. I totally became a shut-in in my parents' house. And this is like, I'd never experienced anything like this. And I was totally just debilitated by these feelings. And it wasn't until a few months later, like it was many months, you know, and we can, you know, talk about what I did to kind of come out of that later. But I mean, just in terms of what happened was my friends came at the end of the semester that I dropped out of, and they were like, yo, we're going to go to a new town for the summer. We want you to come. And as I got out of my parents' house and I got a job, I started talking about what I was going through. I slowly came out of these feelings and I started meeting young people that were inspiring. And so after that summer away, I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and only surround myself with people that inspire me, that like bring me up. And that's when I called this kid, Johnny, from the neighborhood, who was a filmmaker. And I was like, Johnny, you want to make a movie? And that's when the buried life began and this whole adventure started. But it really like, it started from a really hard place, you know, this struggle that I, you know, I ended up learning a lot from, but ultimately made me, like it forced me to make changes. And I was like, I need to surround myself with people that are going to lift me up. And so ultimately that little decision completely changed the rest of my life. I mean, that's why I'm here. And then, you know, the buried life is a whole nother story, but like that was the catalyst back in the beginning. And yeah, I was back in Victoria, BC.
So, and I remember the buried life, and you guys coming around, and I know the guys when they were Reveille, I knew all that stuff and I was around in that world. So, and I remember specifically thinking like, okay, these kids are kids. Like why would anybody give a crap about their bucket list when they're 20 something years old? Like this doesn't make any sense to me. The whole premise at the time didn't make any sense, where it's like, you haven't even lived life long enough to know what you're missing out. Why am I going to watch you do this? So walk me through a little bit of how you overcame that side of it and what it sort of became. And coming from someone young, it actually was, you know, better received than I expected. But again, when it comes to TV, what the hell do I know?
Yeah, like it was, So we decided that, you know, we were faced with some, like Duncan's friend had passed away. So when we were young, we were sort of like faced with, okay, one day we're going to die. What do we want to do with the time that we have left? And so we thought, let's like think about anything we can ever possibly want to do. Let's write it down. And that's where the list came from. But then we thought, well, there's these list items, we're going to need help from other people. So how about every time we cross something off our list, we'll help someone that we meet along the way cross something off their bucket list, right? And it was supposed to be a 2-week road trip in 2006. And, you know, we didn't even know how we were going to cross things off our list or help other people. But I think ultimately the fact that we were asking people, what do you want to do before you die? And then helping them, you know, that ended up becoming really the most meaningful part of what we were doing. And so that, like, just, it just resonated, you know, and people, I think, you know, ultimately having some sort of excuse to think about their life in the present moment and to think and to give people permission, no matter what age, to think about what's important to you and to just understand that, look, you don't know what's going to happen. So take the time to think about what's important to you and like write them down and try and prioritize those things. Because even if you're 21, you could be gone at 22. And if you're 70, you know, you're 70. So like now's the best time to start. You know, you still have tomorrow and the next day. And so I guess it was like we got lucky with the timing where people were just ready for that like positivity. And also, you know, feeling buried and not doing the things you really want to do is human nature, right? Like the name, The Buried Life, is from a 150-year-old poem that talks about this guy feeling this way 150 years ago. So right. It's not a new feeling. And I think it's just a welcome reminder, because you do get buried by the day-to-day, to actually pump the brakes and be like, hey, it's okay to think about what's important to you. And in fact, it's vital for your own well-being and for those around you. And yeah. So,
and then as you guys do the TV show,
yeah,
you know, I figure there's probably that time where you're like, oh, we're going to be TV people and we're going to be TV hosts and we're going to keep doing this. The show goes away at some point, as they all do. You transition sort of remarkably into taking what The Buried Life represented and the sort of, let's just call it positivity to round it around, but take that positivity and be like, okay, I'm going to explain that to other people and speak to other people. Take me a little bit about how you made that transition, because that's kind of impressive.
So our whole philosophy with Buried Life from the beginning was, we're not going to tell people how to live their life, because I never want to tell my friends how to live their life. And that never resonated for us. So we thought, well, why don't we just ask a question? And that's why we were just like, what do you want to do before you die? We're not going to tell you what the answer is. All we're asking is to think about that. And then, by the way, we're going to go and we're going to try all of our biggest dreams. And hopefully, like you get FOMO when you miss a party, you might get FOMO about life and just try and realize that we're no different than you and you can do your thing. So that was kind of like the goal of Buried Life. Now, once like we did the show and the book, and what happened was I got invited to do a TED talk. And I'd just never been ever wanted to tell people how to live. But I thought, you know what, like now it's been like 5 or 6 years. There's definitely things that I've learned that I feel like we could pass on. And so that was the first time that I spoke about the things that, you know, I thought were actually like valuable. And someone saw that and they invited me to speak somewhere else. And, you know, it really kind of snowballed from there. And now I'm just speaking full time and really seeing the impact that it is having. And with people sitting in the audience, it's kind of reinforced this thing. Oh yeah, this is human nature to not really think about these things. And it's a welcome reminder. It's also like a muscle that we need to build, like that awareness of the things, you know, prioritizing our personal goals and also the importance of giving back and how that's actually, you end up giving to yourself by giving back, you know, and that's the type of fulfillment, like at the end of your life, you're going to look back on and those things you won't regret. So it just kind of, it sort of snowballed, you know, organically. But I'll tell you what, like there was a huge dip after the first book and the boys, you know, Johnny, Duncan, Dave, and I, who, you know, the guys that we started The Buried Life together, we started a production company and we started doing some other shows. But then I started getting really burnt out and I ended up again hitting a low. Not as bad as when I was in college.
Right.
Because I had really like built a good network of like healthy habits and things that I knew I needed when I hit those lows. Because by the way, we're all human beings and humans have ups and downs, and that's just the way it is. So, you know, after this, you know, basically realizing that I didn't have any time to be creative in this new role that I had with the production company and stuff. And I was starting to feel depressed again. And I thought, you know what, you know, guys, you take the reins on this. I'm going to, you know, be involved, but not every day. And I was like, I'll do speaking as a stopgap. And then it kind of took off. So like, it wasn't as clean as just, hey, I'm just going to go out and speak. Like,
right.
I was forced to make a change because I was in the gutter again.
Yeah. Like you're just like everybody else. Your overnight success is a deep water of a lot of things tried and going through. That's the way life is. And listen, you know, one of the reasons we've connected so well is that, and I talked about in the intro and earlier in the episode about, you know, I wrote that one Forbes article that I did that was specifically about preparing for success and planning it and being able to enjoy it. And people that I know that are wildly wealthy that haven't figured out how to enjoy that because they never practiced one day how to be and use their success to their advantage and feel like that. And that's been resonating more, you know, almost more than any of the other articles. Just because I think there's something that people are just sort of hungry for that side of it. And you've really captured that from a lighter perspective. Like, I don't hear you telling people what to change and fix their life and do, you know, you're not like the self-help, I'm going to like give you instructions that you have to follow and follow me. It's like, it's a very internal thing that I really find is sort of like, it's an invigorating thing. I listen to you and I'm like, oh yeah, like that's how I feel every day. That's what I like. So
I think now more than ever are just, they feel buried, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's something that is, look, with the rate that we're going with mental health, like this is the greatest crisis that we're facing, right? There's no doubt about it. I think that, you know, you can really tie the opioid crisis with the mental health crisis. I mean, behavioral health and mental health, it's very tied. But, you know, if you look at the rate that people are taking their own life, their own prescription drugs, you know, and I think some of that is based on this, people are not doing the things that are at the core making them happy. And like, I'm not saying that you can, if you're depressed, you can just go and like write a bucket list and go off and you'll be fine. But what I am saying is that like, when you take the time to think about what you believe is going to bring you the most fulfillment and happiness and joy, and that's like really what a bucket list is, right? It's just you writing down. Then all you need is a reminder so that those things don't get swept under the rug and pushed till tomorrow. And when you have a mechanism like either a list or something on your phone or an accountability buddy, like a friend that checks in on you, to actually create that accountability around those things, you just never do them, right? Because everything else has a deadline and you don't have a deadline around those things. So this feels like now more than ever is just welcome, because people need permission to go after those things and know that this isn't selfish. This is for your own well-being.
And I totally get that. Now, you get a lot of people coming to you. I got two questions here, but do you get a lot of people coming to you looking for you to help them like build their list or like fix those things for them? Because I find that I'm getting that a lot more. Like, you know, I've taken a huge step back from the day-to-day of TV and much more into sort of, you know, my sort of coaching and consulting world. And I'm obviously doing this. My travel and adventure club is literally just for fun. But what I find is when I talk to people, they're looking for me to tell them to quit their job and go start a backpacking company or something. Like, they're looking for someone to just tell them to take a leap and some magic pill that'll make them happy. And I look at you and you're a young man, lots of life to live still. You must be like, there's a lot of people that come to you looking for answers. And it's like, I bet there's a lot of older people and they're looking to you for answers. It's got to be a little overwhelming sometimes.
It is, yeah. And it's a very difficult place. No one wants to be in that position where you're having to tell someone that, and no one should be in that position. So what I try and do is I try and bring it back to, you know, okay, well, you're asking me, should you do this or not? You know, or, you know, let's just say someone's like, hey, I don't know, you know, I want to do this thing. I don't know. It's like, okay, well, just picture yourself on your deathbed looking back to this moment. You're at a crossroads. And is your future self, laying on your deathbed, about to die, looking back onto this decision, going to regret you not trying?
Right.
And if the answer is yes, you have to. You have no choice. Right? If your basic needs are met, like if you're not risking your well-being, shelter, safety, you know, like the lower Maslow's hierarchy of needs, then you're not making the decision. Your future self is making the decision.
Yeah. And so how do you deal with that? Like when people are asking you sort of that next step, like what should I be doing? It feels like, you know, people are pinned in their health. And I remember when we had lunch way back when I was like feeling like, and you heard it in my voice where I was like, yeah, it's like TV is not as fun as it used to be, you know? And I was like, and it was that moment. And it was part of the moments of my evolution of, it's like, wait a minute, why am I doing this again? And then you look at the people out there, and I'm just looking at them, just the mail I get even, is just like so many people are in that hamster wheel, the job, the life, the structure, the expectations that they don't love, that doesn't bring them joy. And like Gary would say, like they're praying for Friday to come and they're sad when Monday comes. And it's like, you see so much of that because it's really right at the core of what you speak to. Like, why do people fall into that pattern so sort of like ubiquitous? Everybody's in that pattern. It feels like our entire country's like that. Why is that? Why is it not just a few people? Why is it so many?
Well, partly is we bought into the wrong idea of happiness, you know, that it's getting more stuff, it's making more money, you know, it's climbing the ladder, which by the way are none of the top five regrets of the dying.
Right.
Right. The top five regrets are, I wish I had the courage to live life true to myself. I wish I worked less. I wish I spent more time with reconnecting with friends. I wish I told people how I really felt. Those are the things that people are generally not striving for when they think of their own happiness, which is, you know, as it turns out, when you get there, that's the thing that is the most important. So I think which is just the way that we've been taught, you know, by growing up in today's day and age.
Yeah.
And also, when you're in the hamster wheel, you just don't know you're in the hamster wheel.
Right.
You think you're running until you step out of it and you have perspective. And I think that perspective is sometimes hard to get because you have to force that perspective by actually disengaging yourself from what you're doing to get that perspective. So how do you get that perspective? It's like, you know, a lot of people say you need to take a quarterly offsite with yourself or with your partner, your life partner, right? And leave and turn off your phone and write down like all the things that are important to you and what you want. And that is your true north, right? That you sort of, so like, because of the pace of the day and the grind, you know, we just don't know that we're unhappy. We just don't know that we're running the same spot until we step out and until we like actually have something to keep us accountable on a new path. And then the other thing is like fear, right? So fear is the number one thing that holds us back from going after any type of personal goal, like the fear of what other people might think or the fear of failure, which at the end of the day are both made up fears, right? Because you think about, let's just like break down those two quickly. The fear of what other people might think. The truth is most people are thinking about you less than you think they are.
Right, of course.
And they're worried about other people thinking about them. So they're worried about other people. They're more accommodating than you think. So the fear of what other people think is really like you make that up. And then the fear of failure. Well, if you are waiting for the right time or you never make that shift, you failed. That's a failure. You never did it. But at least when you try and fail, you learn and you grow. I mean, all that stuff is, you know, when you say it, but you don't necessarily live that way.
Yeah. Now let's get real for a second though, because, you know, like I said, you're a ways ahead of where I'm moving towards. You still deal with that fear though, right? Because like 100%. I deal with it every day. Like, it, you know, the book coming, oh my God, it's going to flop. And all of these things that I've been saying and the feel of what other people think, like being a TV executive for so long and then telling people you want to do something else.
Yeah.
Like I said, like I've said in other podcasts, yeah, there's a lot of like
ego.
I mean, there's, I know people are like, what a doofus, or, you know, what an idiot. Like, I know that's out there and that's fine. Like, I live with it and, like, you know, things have gone well so far, so that's great, but it's something I deal with every day. And it's hard for me because I have to go and tell people how to overcome it, how to deal with it, how to push past it, that they should take risks, that they should do things. At the same time, I can't say, oh, you follow the way I did it, because it's been a, you know, it's been a pretty weird, wacky, bent, turned road to where to get to here.
Yeah.
So it's like, but I don't speak to the same sort of higher level kind of stuff that you do. That's got to be hard when you have to tell people those, that advice, and like, you must feel the self-doubt. You must feel like what you're going to do next is not going to be as good as it was before. And you've got a new book. There's no way it's going to sell as much as the first one. Yeah. And no one's going to care, and no one's going to buy it. And then no one's going to want you to speak. I mean, those things are like everyday thoughts for all of us, right? So 100%. How do you deal with that and then tell people not to deal with it?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, and it's a great question, because, and the only thing that I've come to is that these fears will never go away, right? Like the fear of what other people might think, it may be made up, but it doesn't mean that it's less real and that it's not, well, I'm not going to feel it. Like, I'm consistently going to battle with that. But like, I'll give you an example. So most people are, a big fear for them is public speaking. Right. And you listen to like Tim Ferriss talk about it. He's done TED a bunch of times. I mean, he's an incredible speaker. He's a, you know, and he's like, the fear of pre-speaking, like that anxiety, it doesn't matter how many times you do it, you will always get that. But just the awareness of knowing that that is just part of the process, and like being able to identify, okay, this is fear, but also this anxiety, part of it, that is excitement, because anxiety and excitement are effectively the same feeling. So if I can think, one, I know this is normal, like I know this is gonna happen, and so this is part of the process of me leading up to stepping on stage, and that's, I don't like it, but it's gonna happen, so that's cool. And also when I start to feel it, it's like, okay, this isn't all anxiety. Part of this is like me, these are butterflies in my stomach because I'm excited to do this. So I just think the awareness that this is, it's the same as being on the hamster wheel, knowing that everyone, you inherently will be on the hamster wheel unless you kind of check, step back and have that, you know, check in with yourself. The awareness is key, and knowing that, okay, I'm going to feel like this, and that's because I'm a human being.
Right. Now, one of the things I've been adding a lot to when I speak about is the idea of work-life balance, and how I think like that's not a good way to describe it. It's like I'm looking for the people that I work with. I tell them like, you want work-life integration. Like, you don't want to have a separation between what you consider work and what you consider life. It's not like you want to do your life's work and turn that into your job. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the intensity you bring to the office should be the intensity you bring home into your recreational life, into the elements of your relationship. Like, you should be just as good at having fun on the weekends playing with buddies as you are in the office making stock trades. And that's sort of where I'm trying to bridge people's understanding, because that's a little bit where I've taken what, you know, sort of the brand that I'm doing and what I've been doing successfully in my life.
Yeah.
From a, I feel better today than I did 2 years ago.
Yep.
Is I just started matching the intensity I bring to just about everything I do. It doesn't matter what it is. I'm going to see how much I can squeeze fun out of that.
Yeah. Cause you're basically getting energy from work, and you're getting energy from your personal life.
Right.
Like every, so that's the integration. That's like work-life harmony, right?
Yeah.
Like, which is what Jeff Bezos talks about a little bit. And
what are you talking? He talks about that?
He talks about you. He must have got it from you.
No way. No yeah. way. He's lying. He doesn't want work-life harmony. No way. I know people that work at Amazon. There's no harmony working there. I know people that have said that is the most work and the hardest job they've ever done in their lives.
Yes.
And the least fun they've ever had in an office.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that's what I've heard. And it could be just I hear wrong, but
yeah.
There's no way he's talking work-life harmony. Whatever. Oh, anyways, back.
So basically, when you go to work, ideally you're getting like fired up about it. And then when you come home, ideally you're doing things that you're fired up about, which is like, that's my argument for having any type of a list or doing your personal goals. Like, that's going to fuel the rest of your work. And if like the, you said it right. Cause like the work-life balance, that's like saying there's two different people. There's like someone at work and then someone at
right.
Like, it's just, you're the same person. So you, especially with phones and computers, like there's no balance. So
right.
It's a constant ecosystem that you just need to try and be like your best self throughout. And I think there's this misconception that in order to be a leader, you need to give. And I think that you know, for to have real work-life harmony, like you're actually putting yourself first in order to serve others. So like by doing that, you put yourself in a position to be able to not only do your best work, but also be the best leader, you know, family man, like whatever.
Right.
And so that is a really tricky balance.
Yeah.
You know,
because people they tend to ask me like, do you ever have downtime? And I'm like, why would you want downtime? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, to go to work and have that be your uptime and then you go on vacation or whatever and that's your downtime. It's like, that is a recipe. Most of the people I see or I work with, that's the recipe they've used. And it's like, oh, no wonder you're 58 years old and super wealthy and can't figure out how to do anything else but show up at an office every day. And I have a lot of friends who have sold their companies for gargantuan amounts of money and like are still working because it's like, well, I don't
know what else
anything
to
else,
do.
Right? You know? And that's a difficult thing for people to get around. And it's because like, well, because you view your personal life as downtime and mm-hmm. your work life as uptime.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's when you're on and this is when you're off. And that seems very strange to me. And I think that helps to sort of facilitate what you're talking about in that buried life sort of thing where we all feel like that. And it's like, oh, I get to go home and try to get out from under it for a minute. Oh, got to go back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's, if you think about it both, you know, as work and home life, both is uptime, but it's like, what is that uptime? What's the definition of that for you? It could be getting a couple friends and going to a ridiculous adventure. It could be, you know, spending quality time reading with your 5-year-old daughter. It could be like, it doesn't matter what those things are. The most important thing is that you've taken the time to, you know, intentionally think about what is the most important like way and time you can spend in your time away from work so that like, it's just meaningful.
Yeah. Now, so here's the thing. I've watched you sort of grow through this a little mm-hmm. bit over the last couple of years. So, and now I see you at a point where it's like, you should feel pretty good about like, wow, I've achieved this level. Where are you going next? Like, do you need to get bigger and bolder and better than you are today to feel your next level of happiness? Like, where are you? Because the next level for you is there's a big jump. You know what I mean? Like, you gotta go big now.
I gotta go big.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, all signs pointing to like more work, more effort, bigger stuff,
right,
bigger
yeah.
risk.
Which
know?
Is totally the hamster wheel.
Yeah.
way, right. But it is funny that you think, if I think 2 years ago, like if, you know, this would be sort of like my wildest dream goal where I'm at. But right now I'm already thinking about the next thing. And that's a trap that I get into. And a lot of people I imagine get into is like, so I appreciate you saying that. Cause it makes me reflect and think, oh yeah, you know what? I have come a long way, but it, you know, where, what I still don't have is like these things that we're talking about, there's nothing for someone to actually like take away and really like dive into in a meaningful way other than coming to one of my 1-hour keynote sessions, right? And even that's only an hour. So everything that I'm speaking about, I'm now, you know, writing a book about. And so that I feel will be my first like real piece that I can hand off to people. So that I'm really excited about. And then from there, you know, it's kind of just about like getting this, you know, and it sounds cheesy, but getting it out to as many people as possible. So like,
oh yeah, no, I totally get that.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if it's a, you know, what the medium is, but it is kind of exciting to think, you know, you can do just about anything now to get.
Yeah. And get when you find success in it and that's like, you know, you're seeing what you do is affecting people directly. I've seen it. And it's like, it's hard to not be like, okay, well, how do I do that more?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the new book, because, you know, the obviously the Buried Life book that you did originally, big New York Times bestseller, but had a certain tone to it that was specifically, you know, from the show and the list and stuff. What's the new book about, and what's it, and what are you taking into that?
So one of the things that I've learned in the last, you know, probably since I saw you last, right, was is that the thing that I didn't realize when we started Buried Life, you know, when we hit the road and just went after our bucket list, and yeah, I really didn't think anyone would care at all. You know, we thought we'd make the documentary about helping other people, and that would be a cool doc. And but what happened was people heard about it and they saw our list online, and they'd email us and be like, "Hey, I saw like number 9, ride a bull. My uncle has a bull ranch. He can get you on a bull. Or, you know, you want to ride in a hot air balloon? My aunt can help. Or you want to make a toast to a stranger's wedding? My best friend's getting married. I'm the best man. I can get you in the wedding," right? And this flood of people really like rooting for us and wanting us to succeed and cross things off our list. And then being inspired to write their list. That was something that was just, I didn't expect. And so I thought back about what inspired me to start Buried Life, you know, if I trace it back, and it's really this kid in high school who out of the blue started his own clothing line. And it was a really like cool idea. And he just out of the blue with no experience started a clothing line. And I thought, man, that's so cool. And I wanted to get involved. And I thought, if he did that, what can I do? And so I was inspired by like 1% by this kid to think about what I could do. And I thought, I want to make a movie. And I called Johnny, and then the Buried Life began, and that, you know, shifted my life. And so I started to realize that by doing what you love, you actually inspire other people to do what they love. And the ripple effect that has, just like the ripple effect of your Forbes article, the ripple effect that has goes, you'll never know what that is, but it's very real. Like, we've all been inspired by one person, whether we know them or not, that has sort of shifted our life. And I think that, you know, it may sound a little bit grandiose, but like, if more people did what they love, it would change the world. Because happy people make happy families, happy families make happy communities, you know, make happy nations, and happy nations, you know, create peace on earth, right? Like, that's sort of the simple way to look at it. And so it's your obligation to do the things that you truly care about, bring out this true person. Because by the way, you don't want to end up like 76% of the people that die and regret not living their true self.
Right.
Therefore, do the things you love. You don't have to make your living from it, but at least prioritize the things that you love in your off time, because you're going to make an impact in other people's lives just by that ripple effect, right? And so the other side of the ripple effect is by helping someone else. Because when you give to someone else, you help someone else. It's not a one-to-one relationship. You don't just help that one person. You help the people around them, right? Their friends, their family.
Yeah.
And so the book is about this ripple effect and hopefully giving people not only the tools to go after the things they want, but also, you know, the permission to do so, and throughout, you know, just by telling these stories that have happened over the last 10, 15 years.
That's pretty cool. All right. Now, what does your bucket list nab now? Do people ask you that all the time? Or am
yeah,
I just...
Yeah, I think so.
Like,
I
mean, what's on there now?
So it's definitely this book. It's also, man, so we started Buried Life to make a documentary. That's what the Buried Life was. And we've been filming the whole way. And so we've done 91 of 100 of the original list items. The last number 100 is Go to Space. We really want to do something in space and finish the documentary. So, you know, I've been talking to everyone that's in that space, pun intended.
In the space.
And like anything where we can get somewhere close to, I want to finish this documentary. I think this will be the coolest thing that we've ever done. So the documentary, the book, and, you know, I got engaged, so I'm getting married. So that's going to be really exciting. And those are the three things. What about you?
Smaller list.
What's on yours?
You know, I'm ticking them off so bloody fast right now because it used to. It's just like I just like fun. I like doing fun, goofy mm-hmm. things, right? Mm-hmm. So, the book was a big one for me as well because I always wanted to do that.
Yeah, I still. Congrats, by the way. It's like it's going to be awesome.
We'll see. It's nerve wracking. As I can't tell you how crazy it is. It's like every show I've ever produced leading to that one premiere, if they were all done on the same day and they all had me on it. You know what I mean? Like. It's very stressful in that sense. And you know that, so you've been through it. So there's a little of that. I'd really like to expand what I do in my animal rescue stuff. I like that kind of stuff. And those are sort of the big ones, but I'm older than you, right? So I've had a chance to go and tick a bunch of them off. And I'm more focused in my own life. I'm more focused with like going back through my bucket list and like ticking them again and being like, if I never got a chance to tick anything else off, can I make these ones valuable enough that I get to that deathbed and be like, no, I did them all. I did them five times. My concern is, and I spent my entire life looking for the next thing, always trying to get to the next place, always trying to make more money, always trying to do that. Right. And so I spent so much time doing that. I had this big scare effectively that it was like, oh my God, this is what my life's going to become. So thanks to guys like you and to Tony and stuff like that, I like had this a little bit of this epiphany. And so,
and what was the scare? Sorry.
It was just the scare that that's what success was to me, was always trying to find something else.
Right. That so you noticed that.
Yeah. That I might get to the point of my life where I had more than I thought possible, which I already was. I mean, you know, growing up in Victoria, we have slightly different expectations for the size and scope of life than the typical Americans do. We don't have the same sort of ideas. And so, you know, I had passed through my wildest expectations financially and where I was status wise a few times. I never felt like that one single day. And so my issue was, is that I was realizing like I could just keep going like this and never feel like I've won or that I've made it or that I was enough or that this was it. And that it would always be about the next thing. And it was a very wealthy friend of mine that I was working with, who wasn't a friend at the time. He was a business, you know, contact. And I went to his house that he rents in the top of Sunset Plaza. It was a $30 million house or whatever it was. He rents it. He's there a few days a year and that's it. Right. And so, you know, our first few business meetings were there and it was very professional. And then eventually we became friendly and I got to ask him about the house. Oh my God, this house is amazing. Oh, I can't believe it. And so he's like, yeah, I'll give you a tour. So he's giving me a tour and I'm like, my eyes are like, wow. You're like, popping Roger Rabbit out of my head of the view and the pool and the kitchen and the way the doors open up and all these things. In every room I'd go in, I'd have this vision of what I would do if I lived in this house. It'd be so amazing. And the entire time he's so nonchalant and so like unimpressed because it's his place. And he's just kind of like, meh, meh, whatever. Right. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, that's what I do when I give a tour of my house. And people come here and they go like, oh my God. And I'm just like, whatever. Oh, I need to get this fixed. And I just realized like, oh crap. If I could afford a $30 million house, it'd be so cool for a little while. And then I'd be that guy. Cause I've already been doing that my entire life. So that made me rethink all the stuff. And I'm sort of like in this mode of like, if it never gets better than this, could I make this as like the happiest I can possibly be? And so I'm like practicing that as much as I possibly can. So
that's huge, man. Like it's such a blessing to have those types of moments where you sort of, you're hit with it.
Yeah.
Because it's just not intuitive. You're just, you think, oh man, if I just had like, I just want a little more money, you know, if I could just make it to that. And then you're like, wait a sec. If I look back 4 years, my goal was half of what I'm making.
That's right.
Now, and I'm not any happier.
And I move the goalposts.
And I keep moving the goalposts. Yeah. And then you start looking at like, oh yeah. Because people always say, you know, money doesn't make you happy. And it's like, I can say that. I still don't believe that like deep, deep down.
Right.
Until you sort of really step back and you're like, it doesn't. Like,
no.
And there's like all these studies that say up to, I want to say $80,000, I think it is, up to there. The amount of money you have, it's minuscule.
It is.
The increase in happiness that it brings you.
Well, money doesn't buy you happiness, for sure. But what it doesn't do is, and listen, it buys you out of a lot of problems and all those things. There's lots of jokes and memes you can make about that. But the truth is that money doesn't train you how to use money to be happy. And that's the problem. The pursuit of money and achieving success doesn't show you how to use that effectively. And people think that if they can, and I used to think this, if I got more money, I would be able to be happier. And it's like, it's possible, but you have to learn how to do that. And you have to, and I'm like in the Forbes article, you have to practice being good at it. And if it's like I was saying, like if I can't be happy and be good at using the money I have now, then if I was to get more, I wouldn't be any happier because I wouldn't even know how to use it properly.
Yeah.
And that's what people, and it's hard, listen, because I'm like you, I get, you know, young people come to me and ask me for advice. And it's like, I can't say, hey, quit your job and just be happy with the money you have. Because when you're 23 or 27 years old or whatever, it's like, you need to get on the hamster wheel and run really fast.
And it's also like, you know, listen, it's you, I think that, you don't, I'm not going to be a charlatan here and just be like, you don't need money to be happy, you know? But I think that what you're saying is, I think, critical, that you understand yourself enough to know what the money is going, how the money is going to bring you that happiness.
Right. How to use it.
How to use it in the right way. And to be aware that it is a never ending hunger. Like that thirst will never be quenched of having enough, because someone will always have more money than you, and they'll always have X more than you or bigger this or that. And so it's the flip side of the coin, as you said.
Yeah. And it's listen, it's tough. It's an evolution. So people are always looking for you on social media. It's just at Ben Nempton on all the platforms, right?
You got it.
And it's like growing like crazy. That's exciting. Do you like social media? Is it like fun for you, or is it like a task? Because you must get overwhelmed with like requests and messages and like, can you do stuff for me and will you do this?
Yeah, so I didn't know for a while, and I still don't think I figured out like how to be on social media. Like I just don't know how to really put my voice out in an authentic way as someone who will be like telling people what they might want to do, you know? Right. And that's just something that I battled with. So that's been the biggest challenge for me, is like, how do I express myself in a real way that's going to connect with people? And so I've been sort of like practicing that. But I think now that I see that like people are kind of like, okay, this is stuff that we want to hear, I'm just going to just try and be more myself. You know, it's like, what a novel idea.
What a novel idea.
So yeah, so I'll try that.
Well, I'll tell you, everybody on my subscribers, they're very, very loyal, and they will be happily to follow you now. Although I know there's a bunch, because I keep getting requests to have you on as a guest. So I know that there's a good crossover. So Ben, thanks for being here, man. It's good watching it grow.
Yeah, man, it's been awesome to catch up.
Don't not take my call. You know,
never, man. Maybe like I'll have to text.
Yeah, exactly.
No, just kidding. All right, buddy. Thank you.